Riley Hollingsworth.
Thanks for inviting me, and thanks for coming out on a Saturday morning. I notice that people who come out on Saturday morning to radio events are usually pretty serious about it. And I have a philosophy about these things. I try to be brief, I try to be sincere, and then I try to be seated. But we'll have a question and answer session afterwards if you'd like. For nearly 10 years, I traveled all over the country, 99% not at taxpayers' expense, by the way. And I met and I talked with thousands of amateur operators. The job was part psychology, part engineering, part law, and part sociology. I learned a lot more about human nature than I ever cared to know, related to a fraction of a percentage that sometimes caused problems on the bands. I saw a few people who, if they won the lottery, they'd complain about how it was paid out. I met many people who would enthusiastically criticize but would avoid seeing the good points of anyone or anything. Many, many people who had no idea of the wealth and privileges that Americans have compared to the rest of the world, and who had no clue of the vast opportunities and privileges that amateur radio operators have. Now, the important thing here is this is not a reflection upon ham operators, but it's a reflection of society generally. And amateur radio is a cross-section of society, and that's a good thing, but it has both advantages and disadvantages. I learned not to put any credibility in the naysayers or the doomsday people, those who said Echolink would ruin repeaters, or PSK31 would ruin amateur radio, or no-tune equipment would ruin amateur radio. They're just like the AMers in the 1960s who said that single sideband would be the end of amateur radio, and I heard many of them. I ranked these so-called experts and doomsday folks with the following experts who predicted things throughout history. I think there's a world market for about half a dozen computers. That was Chairman Watson of IBM in 1943. There's no reason for an individual to have or even want a computer in their house. That was the president of digital equipment in 1977. Video won't be able to hold on to any market it captures after the first 6 months. People will soon get tired of staring into a plywood box every night. That was Daryl Zanuck, the head of 20th Century Fox Studios, in 1946. And, of course, my personal favorite is from the government. All important machines and devices that need to be invented have now been invented, so the Patent Office is an unnecessary drain on the federal budget and should be closed down. That was chief of the Patent Office in a memo to President Cleveland in 1895. Now, as I said, this is not a reflection upon ham operators specifically, but of society generally, and we all see it in shopping centers and any time we're out in public. Society is different now. We're mad, we're testy, we're very thin-skinned, and you can see that on the amateur bands. Now, a side note regarding no-tune equipment. I have to admit that I thought that for a long time in the early 90s, that no-tune equipment would ruin amateur radio because you didn't have to really do anything to operate it. And I retained a lot of tube equipment, the Drake 4 line and so forth, because I thought that solid-state and digital-type circuits were, first, not understandable, and then, secondly, didn't have any challenge to operating. Then I realized, after looking at a few schematics, just how little I understood about tube equipment, and I was astonished at the quality and reliability of the solid-state equipment. And now, I don't understand digital signal processing, but I went back to the manual of my HT37, and I don't understand phasing either. So I guess it's about the same thing. But having said that, instead of being cynical or jaded after 10 years of enforcement, and a lot of people in the commission told me that it would ruin amateur radio for me to be so closely involved with enforcement every day, instead of that happening, I'm more delighted and optimistic than ever about amateur radio, and really the bug bit a second time for me in amateur radio when I got into enforcement. Because I found over 10 years that it's fundamentally sound, and its strong foundation is people such as you who love radio and who are broad-minded enough to pursue your interests with a passion, and who know that the greatest reward in doing anything is to experience joy in doing it. And you've already made your decision to be part of the solution and not part of the problem. And to have worked with you in restoring amateur radio to its rightful place in our American communications system was the greatest privilege of my professional and personal life, not to mention the most fun. And I'll never forget that period of my life, and I'll never forget working with all of you towards that goal. And that's ironic for me in a way that life came full circle in the radio area. When I was 13, my dad brought home a breadboard shortwave radio, and I built it and I heard hams, and from that moment on I was hooked, and I knew that my life would never be quite the same again. And I'm standing before you now because of those first few minutes of listening on the ham bands and the impression those operators made on me. And I've often wondered if they knew or had any idea that a new recruit was listening to them on the amateur bands. I think a lot of our present operators don't have that. Maybe those guys did. Growing up in the Carolinas, everybody in town knew of Grady Horton and Al Norris and Morris Hall and Joe Abernathy and Dr. Patton. Even people in town who knew nothing about radio knew that they were the town's ham operators. And they knew that when hurricanes hit the coast or when tornadoes came across the Great Smoky Mountains, those people could find out what was going on. And they knew that if you had a son or daughter in service or a missionary in the Andes, you could get a message through. Now recall in the 1960s that making a long-distance telephone call was a very comparatively expensive thing to do, and it was a lot less reliable than it is today. We take it for granted. With our cell phones, we can call all over the country free, but it was not quite that way in the 60s, as a lot of you probably remember. Many mornings that first summer, I rode my bicycle across town about 4 miles to take code lessons from Grady, and then later Morris Hall offered to take me to the Shelby Ham Fest. I never met him before, but he heard there was a kid in town that was wanting to get an amateur license, so he called up and offered to take me to Shelby Ham Fest, which really is a Dayton of the East if you've never been there. And I remember to this day seeing all that equipment, and I got a Johnson Challenger there and then later got my phone privileges. And by the way, when I upgraded to a Valiant transmitter, as you may remember, how many of you remember the old Valiant, EFJ Valiant transmitters? You know they had two 866A mercury vapor rectifier tubes in them that glowed purple when you're on the air. Now, my dad was afraid of electricity, and he never came close to understanding it. And one night I was showing him the Valiant, and he was complaining that I was going to set the house on fire because of those purple tubes. And I told him the tubes were supposed to glow purple when you were talking on it. And then he told me the classic statement he always told me when he was about to impart some great body of knowledge to me. He said, "Now look, son, I've been around the world twice. I was on the Arizona at Pearl Harbor. I've been a hard hat diver, and I dove on the Squalus submarine rescue." He would always bring that up. "You may think you know everything, but I'm telling you, any damn time you make something electric glow purple, you're asking for nothing but trouble." And then he would hastily leave the room. But the point of all this is that all of us are here because we love the magic of radio communications, and we love technical things. And don't you feel sorry for people who have no appreciation of technical things? It's surprising the number of people who not only don't know about it, and that's okay, that depends on the way you grew up, but they have no interest in it. And that's always astonished me. And I think we're very lucky that we have an appreciation and an innate curiosity about how things work. And I guess I got that from my dad, too, because every time he bought something, the first thing he would do is take it apart. And sometimes that resulted in having to buy a second item of whatever it was. But usually he knew how it worked. Now, our problem is, how do we pass on this to young people? It's been said that America is losing its edge in science and technology. And I guess if we're discussing that or wondering about it, maybe it's already happened. But what we're up against in drawing our youth into electronics and radio and TV engineering is this, and this is very important. There is no Main Street America anymore. Maybe in a small town in Kansas, or Iowa, there would be a Main Street America. But basically, all across this country, there is no Main Street America anymore. You wouldn't let your kid ride a bike 4 miles across town, anywhere around here. And if somebody you didn't know called up and wanted to take them to a ham fest, of course you'd want to run a criminal background check. It's just a sad note of our times, a sad characteristic of our times. I'm often asked, will amateur radio survive the internet? Well, it already has. When the telegraph was invented, that was the Victorian internet. And when you go back and read the books on the development of the telegraph and the reaction of the public to it, it's very similar to our reaction of the development of the internet today. And people say, well, yeah, that's true, but amateur radio absorbed telegraph and Morse code and so forth. But then look at PSK31 and voice over IRLP, Echolink, and Winlink. And you'll see that amateur radio developed a lot of those technologies, and amateur radio has absorbed it and enhanced it. There's so many challenging facets of amateur radio today to pursue that you could spend a lifetime doing it. And many of us have and hope to continue doing that. Just the ability to make thousands of contacts worldwide on all the bands and on all modes with a small box weighing about 9 pounds is absolutely mind-boggling. So all those naysayers now are just like the AMers in the 1960s. Now, I get a lot of questions about code. What's going to happen to amateur radio now that you don't have to know the code? Well, I found that interest seems to be increasing now that you don't have to know it. And I'm thinking that maybe the code was analogous to a book in high school. A lot of good books were ruined because they were put on the required reading list. And it was only later in life that you went back and picked up that book. And so I remember hating this book in high school. I think I'll read it now. It looks interesting. And this is the critical thing, too. 0.7% of amateurs filed comments in the code rulemaking. 0.7%. So the people that come up and rail to me about eliminating the code, in the first place, enforcement didn't eliminate it. But in the second place, if it wasn't important then, how can it be important now? I'm thinking maybe that it'll turn out to be a stroke of genius. We won't know for about 10 years, but our numbers are way up, and there's safety in numbers. I've ran across a number of people who came into amateur radio since the code was eliminated. They're very good operators. One fellow was a CBer, never could quite master the code. He came into amateur radio full course. He's president of a club up in New Jersey. He's head of the field day. And he only got licensed a few years ago. And he's going to beat me to the DXCC award. And he only needs one more country to do it. But he's a convert to amateur radio, and it's just a tremendous asset. But we won't know for a long, long time, and I'm afraid I won't be with you to find out, because by that time, too many Hamfest hot dogs will have taken their toll. I don't expect to be around. But the main point here is it's not about the code. It's about what you're doing right now to further amateur radio and what you're doing to welcome new folks into your ranks. And as Joel Harrison, the previous president of the league, said recently, embrace the change. The only certainty is change, particularly in a technological area. And Dave Sumner of the league said, what counts is not what you did to get into ham radio, but what you do once you get into it. And there's a lot of truth in that. I think that if anything destroys amateur radio, it'll be attitude. And that's the attitude, going back to the first part of this presentation, the attitude that is prevalent in our society, the quickness to take offense. People just assume that you've done something against them. If you take a parking place in Walmart, I've noticed, there'll be three people who know that you came out there just to steal that parking place from them. It's just our attitude, the way we are these days. And I've watched, you can see it. You can see it in traffic. Have you ever noticed how somebody flies up to a yield sign like they're going to get out right now? People will speed up to close the gap to keep them from getting out. But if you ease up there, with the attitude or the appearance, man, I'd sure like to get out on that highway today. They'll slam on brakes to let you out. People are assuming somebody's trying to take something from them most of the time. If technology would destroy amateur radio, it would have died a long time ago, shortly after the microphone was invented. Because the biggest problem on amateur radio is people's mouths. And getting back to attitude, I got a call from a frequency coordinator back in the winter wanting to know the best way to deny a coordination request and get by with it now that there had been a change in enforcement. And I said, well, why would you want to deny it? And he said, well, the kid's 16 years old. He wants to set up a repeater, and he's 16 years old. And I said, I wish we had thousands of problems like that all over the country. And it's just that attitude that scares me. There's really nothing to be afraid of in amateur radio. There's no grab for HF frequencies. In fact, Dave Larrabee from the monitoring station, who recently retired, but he works with governments all over the world, says that from a government standpoint, interest in HF is dying. That's good for us. But he said the governments want digital, they want satellite, they want fiber optics. So I think that if our frequencies are nibbled away, it will be at the top of the very highest frequencies. But I don't really see much of a threat there, and I don't see a threat to our frequencies at all. The main thing is our attitude and our relation to each other on the bands. Now, there's an apparent scarcity of young people, and I noticed that, and you look at our demographics this morning. You go to Dayton and look at the demographics, or Shelby, or any place, and if the demographics don't change soon, the biggest problem at Dayton is going to be where to park the walkers. Because I tell you, we're getting old. We're getting really old, all of us. But that may be changing too, because surprisingly enough, last year we got 33,000 new licensees, a phenomenal amount. And the vets tell me that this year is shaping up to be the same way. And if that's true, if we could have a couple of years of growth like that, then, as I said, there's safety in numbers. The commission and any other entity that might be interested in our frequencies see this increase in numbers and will be a factor to be dealt with. We need to have more of an interest in what's going on and more of a knowledge of what's going on. So if you don't read anything else, at least read Sumner's editorial in QST every month. During the height of the BPL crisis, and I'll tell you what, BPL worried me more than anything that ever developed related to amateur radio, and I think it was more dangerous to us than the shutdown during the World War. And I had a great fear that some of the BPL people would listen to 75 meters, the arguments and the fighting that you heard in the early 90s, and maybe tape record that and take it to a congressional subcommittee and say, you're worried about protecting these people from BPL? Well, this is what we hear on the bands. I think that would have been the end of us. It didn't happen, fortunately, but it scared me. And I tried to reach some of the worst characters one-on-one and explain that, if nothing else, they should appreciate the BPL threat. But a couple of them asked me, what is this thing about BPL anyway? They weren't even aware of the issue, and they didn't know what BPL was. And we have to be versed in all of the issues. We're also being told, and last year this was true, and it looks like it's going to be true this year, that about 25% of the new licensees are coming in through the CERT program. In other words, coming in just for the emergency communications aspect of it. But we need to recruit them into all facets of amateur radio, or else they'll soon drop out. We've got to consider them a new recruit, even though they passed a test and they got an amateur radio for emergency communications. They need to be shown about working DX or PSK31 or checking into nets or CW or all the many things that you can do on amateur radio, or they'll soon drop out. Or they'll drop out when they don't have a job in emergency communications anymore. Or they just won't use it except for drills and so forth. Now, the same applies to the kids, the new licensees, the young people in our clubs. So many clubs do a good job of giving classes and tests and recruiting young people, but then don't follow up with those people afterwards. And a lot of those people will soon drop out. if you don't take them under your wing and show them and encourage them and keep teaching them about amateur radio and all the different facets that we can do and help them set up stations and so forth. And you can help amateur radio the most by appreciating what a great privilege it is and realizing and advertising to others what doors it's opened and will open for you, and trying some way to repay the debt of amateur radio. Every gift of lasting value comes with responsibility. And that's the main thing. Every gift of lasting value comes with responsibility. In the 60s, 70s, and maybe early 80s, we didn't have to worry really about anything. Commissioner Lee on the FCC loved amateur radio. He never could pass the code either, but he loved amateur radio. And we sort of knew that nothing much would happen to amateur radio as long as Commissioner Lee and Barry Goldwater were in office. And we don't have them anymore. And we have to survive on our own, and we have to have the public exposed to amateur radio. And I was having a conversation with Jay this morning about field day. Too many field day operations are not anything that the public can see. And field day is an ideal way to advertise amateur radio. I was at Lake Codorus up near Hanover, Pennsylvania, this summer, and I happened to notice on the it was what they call Codorus Blast. It's one of the biggest festivals in that area. It's an annual festival that must draw 10,000 people. All kinds of events going on over a 2-day period. And I happened to look up on the hill, and I saw a TA-33, or what looked like a TA-33 beam up. And so I walked around there. It was roped off with yellow evidence tape, and I went under that. And it was a beautiful field day operation by one of the local clubs. But nobody at that festival could get to it or even knew that it was there. There were no signs advertising it. And if you would happen to walk up on it, you would stay away from it because of the tape. But that would have been an ideal way to expose amateur radio to thousands and thousands of people to see what it is. And in fact, after I went home, I found out there was a second field day installation there at Lake Codorus State Park, and I never saw that. So you can bet that the public didn't see it and get interested in it, or at least be exposed to it, because if the public knows what amateur radio is, or our commissioners know it, or planning commissioners, or whatever, if the public knows what amateur radio is, then we stand a better chance when it's threatened to have it fully understood and have the value of it fully understood. The inventor and the tinkerer in the basement is a keystone of our technological innovation. From sideband right on through to Peter Martinez, the English fellow that invented PSK-31 and made it free to the world. Because that passion is a more attractive force than any commercial our pecuniary interest ever will be. Now, understand that your group is very active in emergency communications. And I'll tell you, these hundred-year events, weather events that happen now about every 4 years, they're terrible, but it's been a blessing for amateur radio, because ever since Hurricane Hugo, and I think it was 89, was it? People started to understand the value of amateur radio. All of our communication systems, the cell phones, the internet, they work beautifully most of the time. But they are as delicate as they are advanced. And 9/11, our own internet system of emergency communications at the FCC went out. A lot of cell phone circuits you couldn't use because the media gets on the cell phone and stays on, so they won't get a busy signal when they call back to give the report. So they'll hold that line for hours. And your amateur radio communications is really the only fail-safe option, and you've got to market yourself that way. And it's fail-safe because you have no central tower, no central control. You're all about half crazy. You have your own equipment, and you'll get the message through. And this was true in Hugo and Andrew and the tsunami. It was an Indian amateur radio operator that got the first words out about the tsunami. That was in Sri Lanka. And same way in Haiti. Our cell systems and internet systems are great, but they're delicate. And they always remind me of a bumper sticker I saw in a Jaguar one time. The bumper sticker said, "But oh, when it runs." And I've often wondered, we really show our best in emergency communications. And after 9/11 especially, emergency communications entities, state and local, were scrambling to have backup systems with amateur stations. And I wondered, why is it that we do so well in emergency communications? And why do all the emergency communications that you handle, it turns out to be an excellent situation? During the last big hurricane that we had, Katrina, the Salvation Army Team Emergency Radio Network had handled 1,500 health and welfare messages before the feds even knew what a problem they had down there. And so that's 1,500 instances where somebody did not call 911. They didn't call the local police or sheriff or medical facility to check on somebody. And they did it quietly. They operated for days on end. And then when it was over, they went back about their business, and you never heard much more about it. And probably the public doesn't realize it, or those that do have forgotten. And then I ran across the definition of excellence recently, and I wasn't able to get the author because it was a little magazine I saw on a plane somewhere, and I didn't take it home with me, but I did copy this down. And it applies, and I think describes amateur radio operators as they work in emergency communications. And it said, excellence is the result of caring more than others think wise, risking more than others think safe, dreaming more than others think practical, and expecting more than others think possible. And I think we see that in the emergency communications element of the amateur radio service. Now, getting back to enforcement. As to enforcement, you must never tolerate your service being neglected again, as it was for about 12 years during the explosion of paging systems and cellular systems and SMR systems. I don't see any reason that it would be neglected again. The program's very important to the Commission, particularly now since it ties into Homeland Security and emergency communication. But you've always got to be diligent, and you must never again let it go through years of neglect. You've got to always respectfully demand the same enforcement attention that you got for almost 10 years after the FCC finally responded to pressure from the League. And you have to use every resource you have to prevent that happening again, that is, the neglect of amateur radio. And should you see it coming, you need to work with your congressional delegation, the League, any pressure point you can find. And like I say, I don't see that in the cards, but we've always got to be vigilant about that and never let it happen again, because it was your pressure and especially the peer pressure on those who didn't comply with the rules that really was a tipping point in the amateur enforcement program. And I had a distinct advantage because in the early years of when I was doing it, you could release every letter that you wrote. Now, with privacy being ratcheted down more and more, and it's kind of ironic that privacy issues are and rules are more restricted today, but today we have less privacy than we've ever had. But anyway, what you see that Laura releasing on the FCC site is just the tip of the iceberg. As far as present-day enforcement, you're in very, very good hands with Laura Smith. She comes from a family, a background of enforcement. Her father-in-law was a longtime head of the Enforcement Bureau. Her dad's a policeman. She used to work for the commission, and she worked a lot in amateur radio rules. And she's very, very good. And the fellow that works next door to her, I've known for years. In fact, we hired him. He says she comes in early, she leaves late, and she loves it. So that's exactly what we need. So you're in very good hands. And keep up with the issues. Watch the FCC website. You go to the Enforcement Bureau website, and you'll see a listing of amateur radio enforcement actions. You can see them also on the League website, although since they have rearranged the website, it's not exactly as predominant as it was, so you have to do a little digging define enforcement actions. And like I say, what you see is only the tip of the iceberg, because now they only post final actions in enforcement cases. And the advantage I had was that thousands and thousands of people lived in fear that their name might appear in an enforcement letter and be in QST magazine and be on the FCC website and Newsline and everything else. It's a great deterrent. And she doesn't have that advantage, but she's doing a very good job from what I hear and what I see, and I think we're very lucky to have her. We also have, as you notice, a female president of the league, which is a good development because it's going to give a different face for amateur radio. So many chiefs in the commission are women now. Amateur, the enforcement bureau chief is a woman. My boss in D.C. was a woman, and Kay will present a different face for amateur radio, because so often we've been perceived over the years as a bunch of old, fat, white people. That's the way the commission looked at us. And maybe we are, maybe a lot of us are, but the whole population's aging. Aging is not just particular to amateur radio. You can see it on subways, shopping centers, everywhere else. The whole population is aging, and it's happening in all the Western societies. But we need a different face and a different approach. But in conclusion, how lucky we are to appreciate the magic of radio. It's just a blessing to be amazed by that. And to this day, when I work a station on 80 meters or 75 meters with a wire across the roof of the house, it astonishes me how I can work Canada or anywhere long distance with just a wire across the roof. And we're so lucky to have that magic of amateur radio. And we need to show that and demonstrate it. And I'll work with you any way I can. And we must all work together to ensure that, and this is my personal goal for amateur radio, to ensure that amateur radio lasts 1,000 years. That should be our attitude. Thank you. I'm taking questions you have if we have time. Over here.
Yeah, one of the features of Loudoun County is its tremendous growth, which means lots of people in a small place. Most of the people on the eastern part of the county have a homeowners association that belongs to. I think it's an impediment to amateur radio when homeowners associations take a very firm view on. People need to either consider self-intent or as you know, they don't work it well. But I don't think an amateur radio operator is necessarily looking to put up a 200-foot tower on a human being. They just look for something outside that you might see from the street. Mm-hmm. Works. What do you see in terms of developments along those lines of opening up possibilities of some relief?
Well, the bill in Congress will be a good start if it goes through. The commission stayed out of it because the commission feels, and it's probably true, that it isn't the role of a regulatory agency related to communications to tell people they can't live in a gated community. Our community with a homeowners association that won't let you have a birdhouse or a clothesline. It just wasn't the role of the FCC to do that. But that's probably our biggest problem right now, because when you look at the urbanization over the last 25 years, so many people are going into places where they have associations. And I've seen some very sad cases where people go in and at the signing, they see the restrictions that are part of this development. And so often, a developer, although this has certainly come to a screeching halt in recent years as far as explosive housing developments, but what would happen is a development would get started, and one developer would get the boilerplate language from another developer or someplace else, never having in mind anything about antennas, but it's in that language. Almost all the language is the same. So it spreads like a cancer among all these developments. And I agree with you that the amateur radio is not a 150-foot tower or a cubicle quad in the backyard. Sometimes it's a very simple antenna system that's very unobtrusive. And with our getting back to our incredible transceivers are incredible equipment today. You don't need that stuff to talk all over the world that we used to need. High hopes for that, and the league has instructions on how you can comment on it. But I think that will be a start. But that is the biggest problem, because as we get older and go into more restrictive communities and maybe retirement homes, we don't want to have to give up that ability. Now, there's a big retirement home in Goshen, Indiana. It's huge. And a radio club there in Goshen, Indiana, worked out a deal with the retirement community to let them put up a 75-foot tower and some antennas in exchange for showing them by amateur television the parades, things that were going on in town, getting them the weather reports, and opening it up to people in the retirement community that used to be amateurs or had a license and couldn't use it. And it's very, very successful. They have a very good working relationship, and you'd be surprised at the number of people that come over from the retirement home to use that amateur radio station. You know, we don't want to think in terms of recruitment, just in terms of young people, because I was talking to the retirement community set up a seminar to talk about amateur radio, and I went up there and gave a talk, and probably 90% of the audience were not licensees. They were just residents of the retirement home, and they wanted something to do, some different stimulus, so they came to this meeting. And I asked them how many of them had been on the Internet in the last month. And I'll tell you, it must have been 75% that raised their hands. The older people are a great recruiting source for amateur radio. They all have computers to talk to their kids and grandkids. And some of the best instructions I've gotten about a computer have come from somebody that is really much older than I was, and they can learn that stuff, and they're hungry to learn. They have the time to learn it, and they have the ability to use various facets of amateur radio, such as, I don't want to keep harping on this, but such as PSK31 with very simple antenna systems. So we need to recruit from all age groups. But the short answer is, I think that the bill that's floating around in Congress now, I don't know the exact status of it, but you can find out on the league website, will go a long way towards that purpose. And with people realizing just what amateur radio did during 9/11, during Katrina, and so forth. Any other questions?
I'd like to thank you for the excellent work you did in the past 10 years. Fantastic.
Anybody else?
Right here. So, okay. Said enforcement. You're a very successful person. Did you have an unsuccessful case that you're willing to share with us?
Yeah, there are a lot of unsuccessful cases, but you know, you don't need to get all of them. If you can only get a large percentage of them, it changes the chemistry on the band, because it only takes two or three people on a band to ruin it. And so you can change the chemistry. There are a couple of open cases now that I have that are still going on. They'll be coming to fruition this year, because sometimes justice is like stomping the tail of a dinosaur. It eventually gets the message, but it takes a while. So I can't comment on those. But a lot of the cases were ongoing, because the reality of it is, and I was discussing this at breakfast this morning, they were very sad cases. It was people with drug problems, Vietnam veterans who had mental problems. There are many, many of those in the amateur service, and we'll be dealing with that same thing with people coming back from Iraq. But many of the problems on the bands were drug-related and Vietnam injury-related cases. And you have to have some compassion for that, because for many of these people, that's the only life they have. You'd be surprised the number of people that live alone or live with their mom or brother, and the only life they have is amateur radio. And they'll go crazy on the bands. They'll destroy a frequency. Then they'll go into remission for 6 or 8 months. And they would call me up threatening to come to Gettysburg and kill me, and the next day they'd call and they'd be in tears because the medication ran out or they have another problem. So the threats didn't mean anything except that it was a sad case. And I think, some of the most notorious, a scary percentage of the most notorious problems on the bands were related to that. Because, as I said, we're not immune from society. We're a cross-section. So to the extent you have mental problems in society, war veterans, people with drug problems, alcohol problems, you're going to see the same thing on the amateur bands. And so that's why there's no one magic bullet for enforcement. You have to look at each case, and sometimes a one-on-one conversation with a person would cure the problem, just talking with them. Sometimes the wife or the girlfriend is the best enforcement tool we had. And that's the reason we so often sent tapes to people to have them comment on them. We didn't care if they listened to the tapes, but what we knew is the wife would say, "Joe, what's in that package we got yesterday?" He said, "Nothing." "Well, where'd it come from?" "The FCC." "And there's tapes in there." And when she listens to them, you never hear from that operator again. I guess somebody gets a very good deal on amateur equipment, but that was the best enforcement tool. Another good enforcement tool is a wife or girlfriend standing in the door of the radio room with the operator not knowing it. One particular case always still worries me a little bit. When I first got into amateur radio, I hadn't really been that active. I checked in the nets a few times a year, and as I said, had the old equipment. But I probably didn't make more than 20 contacts a year. And so when I got into enforcement, I started listening around, and I was appalled at how bad it sounded. And it ruined a lot of nights and weekends tuning around the band. And one Friday afternoon, there was one case that particularly aggravated the hell out of me. And I knew it was going to ruin my whole weekend. So I decided to make a phone call and try to discuss the case one-on-one. And man's wife answered the phone, and I asked for the amateur radio operator that lived there by call signing by name. And she said, "Well, that's my husband. He'll be home about 6. What's this about?" And I said, "Well, I can't. I'd rather go into it with him when he gets home asking me to call him." And she said, "No, tell me what it's about. And we'll see if we can solve it." So I told her, and it had to do with, of course, deliberate interference and the related things that you always get, the obscenity and so forth. And so I said, "I need to talk to him about such and such," and I went over the complaints. And there was a pause on the phone there, and she said, "Well, I'll tell you what, he gets home at 6, and I can guarantee you after about 6:15 tonight, you won't ever have this problem again." I don't know whatever happened to the guy. I guess there was a big yard sale, because we never heard from him again. And it still bothers me. And sometimes a year or two later, I think, maybe I ought to call that guy. If it wasn't all that serious, but maybe I ought to look into it. Then I said, no, we'll take enforcement anywhere we can get it. And so things like that work. And you can't just say, "Well, we're going to revoke all these licenses." Because in some cases, a forfeiture works better. In some cases, it's just not necessary. And a revocation ties up the enforcement resources. Because you've got to have investigations. You've got to start the case. The judge has got to get it. You've got to do the argument, propose findings. And, of course, in America, you can appeal anything. And so no matter how ridiculous the person's case is, if he loses, he'll appeal it, probably. So the main thing is to get them off the air and change that chemistry, to get them out of the service. And that's one reason we did so many testing recalls. I found out, much to my surprise, that there had only been one retest up until 1999. There had only been one person called in for a retest. And the rules plainly say that if the person was not tested by field office, that you can call them in for a retest. So we called in a few. We called in one person just because he had an extra class license and asked on the air what a dipole antenna was. He didn't show up for the exam. And then we got allegations in Puerto Rico of license fraud and selling licenses. And one person called our office to complain that he had gone to an amateur exam with his $100 and they wanted $200. And they had told him he could have gotten it for $100. So we opened up the case in Puerto Rico and recalled about 175 licensees in Puerto Rico, and 3 showed up. And so the word got out that you could be retested, and so that helps, too. And of course, we have our revocations and the forfeitures, and the most important tool, the most powerful tool, and this is one that most of these people forgot, is that when you get up to your renewal period and you apply for renewal, you have the burden of proof, if it's questioned, to show that you're qualified to retain that amateur license. We don't have the burden of proof of showing that it should be revoked. You have the burden of proof as an applicant to show that you're qualified. You have to travel to Washington, D.C., as the Crowell case in California, he's finding out. You have to travel. You can't do it through a conference call, a video, or anything else. You have to travel and be present personally in front of an administrative law judge in D.C. who wants to see you face-to-face and judge your credibility and show, if we challenge it with a hearing designation order, and show that you're qualified to retain that license. And that is a huge deterrent, because almost nobody gave us problems within about a year of their license renewal. And that's one reason I'd like to see the term go back to 5 years. It only went to 10 years as a labor-saving device during the period where the big job of government was decide what they didn't have to do anymore and what they could contract out and save labor. It was labor-intensive then. Now it's an automated process. So a five-year renewal would make probably more sense from enforcement. But the volume of complaints were seriously down when I left. It was just a sprinkling of a few people. You're going to always have some percentage that cause problems, just like you have some percentage on the highway that drive recklessly, or some percentage of, what do they call them, crotch rockets that go by you on the beltway at 85 miles an hour. It's always going to be there. But the thing is to keep that percentage down so that it doesn't detrimentally affect the amateur radio service as a whole. And I will say, I never saw any difference in the enforcement challenge between somebody with somebody who never had code or never learned the code, as compared to an extra class licensee. In fact, I once went back over our 10 worst cases, and every one of those were extra or advanced class licensees. And so if I hadn't known that code was eliminated, I would never have known it from an enforcement standpoint, because it just doesn't seem to make any difference in conduct. And in fact, oftentimes it's the extra class operator who's been on the same frequency every night for 10 years using 1,200 watts to talk across the state that thinks he knows everything and doesn't want to hear any new operators or any new information that causes the biggest problem. And they think they own the frequency. The new people just don't seem to have that attitude, and they seem to be much easier to work with. That's a long answer to your question.
Related to that, okay, so now you've done with the people, so it sounds like you spend most of your time with people. Were there also equipment related?
Problem? Not very often. There were situations where somebody had the Vox on, or they were operating split and they didn't know it. And probably all of us have done that. But those are very easy to solve if you can figure out where they're coming from. And the field can do it, but a lot of times somebody on the frequency knows who it is, or somebody in the town. And just to give you an example, to make a short answer excruciating, during one of the hurricane emergency net operations, we kept hearing this guy come on just with a burst of profanity. It's like every minute or two, just a burst of profanity. And we couldn't figure out why. It didn't seem to be directed at the net. But when I listened to what he was saying, it kind of reminded me of what I said when I can't get the lawnmower to run or a piece of equipment to work. And it was just common terms, you know, that guys use when...
We would call that pilot talk.
I guess so, yeah. But as it turns out, it was a fellow listening to the hurricane emergency net working on a 2-meter radio that he couldn't get to work, and the Vox was on. And when we called him about it, he was extremely embarrassed and offered to take a 6-month suspension and so forth and so on. But the point is, the problem was gone. But there's not many cases where it's just equipment, except where it's unintentional. And 90% of interference on the bands is absolutely unintentional. It's somebody just not listening, somebody spinning the VFO knob and tuning up, not realizing that it's landing on a QSO because they want to tune up for 39.15, so they flip it up to 39.20, tune up, and then go back to 39.15. 90% of it is non-intentional. I've listened to arguments on 40 meters before as to who was causing the interference, and we knew from direction finding that it was a South American broadcast station that had gone haywire. And that's why I've cautioned people, just don't react to it. Because if it is deliberate interference, you're going to make it worse, because the people who do interference deliberately just want a reaction. And they don't care what the reaction is. They just want to stir things up and sit back and listen. And that's why it's just very important to report it if it's a regular thing, but not respond to it, because in 90% of the cases, it's absolutely unintentional. And a lot of times isn't even coming from an amateur operator, because there's all kinds of RF stuff out there today. And shortwave stations in other countries don't quite have the standards that we do. And when they go haywire, they don't have the same sense of urgency to fix it. So what our people might fix in a day, they may go for 5 or 6 weeks. They'll eventually do it, but there's no sense of urgency. And a lot of what you hear on here is some form of that, or maybe it's a fax machine in Norfolk that's gone haywire. Arpston's wave measuring machine that they have in the Gulf that measures wave height at least 3 or 4 times, that was accidentally put on the amateur frequency. And people just knew that somebody in Indiana was deliberately interfering with the net, and it wasn't. It was that machine, and when the direction-finding people found out who it was, they called them, and it was solved. So that's why it's most important to ignore it. And as I've said many times, probably to a nauseating degree, when you look at radios in the 1950s and 60s and compare them to what you'd see at HRO today, they all have one thing in common, and that is the biggest knob is the VFO. It's that way for a purpose. Just change frequencies and go somewhere else. We have thousands and thousands of discrete frequencies we can use. Spin the knob and go someplace else. And it's not going to kill some of these nets to change frequencies or just shut down until it's over. One net had a pretty novel way to solve it. They got some routine interference, which was deliberate. But the net control would say, okay, we've got this interference, we're going to frequency B. And then they'd just shut down for 30 minutes and not get on. And we knew that the person interfering was frantically going all over the bands trying to find them. And couldn't find them, so he lost interest. And half hour later, they'd come back on successfully. There's all kinds of different ways to do it. Well, thank you for inviting me, and thanks for coming out on a day like this, a Saturday morning, too.
Very, very nice.